Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stay glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in, since they going back to showing action tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the Anime Action Fan Sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
Hey there, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative, right here on the Absolution Network. I'm, of course, your primetime host, Thomas Primetime Mattis. And on this episode of The Prerogative, episode 117, we decide to go from zero to hero as we take a look at Walt Disney's 1995 classic Hercules as we finish off Disney Month. Yes, the final episode of this year's Disney Month, which is kind of funny since I've kind of crammed all of Disney Month in the span of 2 weeks. Outside factors! But, you know, it's funny, last week we were in Disney Renaissance, as it's called, and we actually reviewed a film from the early Renaissance that's probably not as well known, and a lot of people still don't know as Disney Renaissance. Though here we definitely have a film that's in the back half of the Disney Renaissance, and it's kind of panned for different reasons. You know, I've talked about this before. You know, you have that early part with Mermaid, Belle, Beauty and the Beast. Beauty and the Beast will from now on be known as just Belle. Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and Lion King, and then on that back half, you had Pocahontas, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Hercules, and Mulan, and yeah, throw Tarzan into there as well. In its own way, Tarzan is its own separate beast, because it at least had a movie in between it, though I guess the same could be said I think Pocahontas, and then it was either Toy Story came out after Lion King, and then Pocahontas? Yeah, I think that's what it was. Which kind of separate the two eras as well. And one thing we do definitely talk about here on The Prerogative, whenever we review Disney Renaissance, in particular at the back half, as we did with Pocahontas, and Hunchback, and Mulan, and we're going to do it here again, is to explore, you know, just what it is that audiences didn't like, because while these films were successful, enough of the audience had issue with it, and there was enough issues for Disney, I want to say creative, but it's not creative, but Disney corporate, to take advantage of, or at least attempt to. So to be quite honest in talking about that, these films, while bleeding to it, aren't the ones that put the nail in the coffin. No, that's a war films like Home on the Range, Treasure Planet, and Journey to Atlantis, which your mileage may vary on those movies. though I do kind of find it funny that of all the movies up on Netflix, you can't find Home on the Range on Netflix. Gee, I wonder what Disney would be jamming that one. But, and don't forget to throw Brother Bear 1 and 2 into there. Oh god, I forgot to talk about Brother Bear 2. Well, that did go on theaters, but anyways. So, we're definitely going to explore the elements that started in the Disney Renaissance that were definitely used to justify the move completely away from hand-drawn to CG, which definitely started in the back half of the Disney Renaissance. You know, and again, this is a matter of elements of hand-drawn being blamed for other elements while CG rising in its productivity and influence and popularity. So that's definitely something we are going to explore here with Hercules. Again, and I say this because I don't think all the criticism is fair, definitely, you know, in doing the research I saw, like Mulan would be later with by China, this movie was also panned and hated by Greek critics. You know, can we just let a movie be a movie, and can a movie just be about entertainment? Does it have to teach every important lesson in the book to everybody? You know, I have such high praise and high standard for Disney movies, but part of the reason that they're able to teach these morals and have these great themes and everything is because the whole part of it is they have an expectation of you going into this movie to be entertained, and they're going to entertain you while having some actual deepness to it. But if you go, and I know this seems strange, well, why wouldn't you go into a movie that you know is going to have deep themes and everything and not expect deepness? Well, that's because Disney films, like a lot of the best films, work on emotion. And they need you to be emotionally evolved. Well, if you go into a film looking for deep meaning into it and trying to think about the film rather than emotionally enjoy the film, you know, then you're not going to enjoy it. Now, let me emphasize something. There is a difference between you going into a film thinking, and then at some point the film losing you on an emotional level, and you starting to just think about it, like Maleficent did last year. You know, I have a lot of criticism for Maleficent, and I make mention of the whole feminist taking the power back from the man. You know, the man assaulted me, and so, you know, the only way for me to get over my assault is to, you know, physically assault him and take power back from him. And I make mention of that because I went into that film really excited, and I was emotionally involved, and I loved the beginning, and I'm like, okay, I'm okay with this happening to the King Stefan and everything. And then it got to the good fairies, and what they did to him offended me so much, I stopped emotionally enjoying the film and started thinking about it. And that's one of those crimes that a film commits that completely hurts it. Now, I say that opposed to Cinderella, where I was completely emotionally attached to everything that movie did, and that's part of my enjoyment. And I bring this up here because there are certain elements, we'll talk about this film, that I think people lost their emotional attachment to and started thinking about. And the thing about it is, these are things that worked in the past for Disney films, in particular the early Disney Renaissance, but because certain devices weren't in place, and I had this discussion a couple days ago with some friends of mine about this, and we, not an argument as in we were yelling at each other, but we, you know, debated and argued in a debating tone back and forth about it, though I was, they were kind of mad at me for starting this thing, Let It Go, because I'm an asshole, and anytime I want to be very cute in that annoying way, because, you know, we love being assholes to each other, but anytime I want to be an asshole, you know, if somebody says the word Let It Go, I'm going to be the mother effer, and I start singing, let it go, da-da-da-da-da-da, and then I immediately have stuff thrown at me. You're probably saying, but Tom, don't you hate Frozen?
Yeah, I hate Frozen.
I still do hate Frozen. Which is why I love ruining that song. Because that's what I'm doing. Because, like I said, well, let me put it in a Dennis Leary way. I'm an asshole, yo, 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 yo. I'm an asshole, yo, 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 yo. But off Dennis Leary and back on topic. So, that's all the things we're going to be exploring. We're going to have some fun because, you know, again, this is Ryan Clements and John Musker, same people behind Aladdin and Little Mermaid. All the great animators, Andreas, Deja, Glenn Keane, Nicky Rodalas, all of them, the great animators of Disney working on this. Alan Menken doing the music along with, I believe it's David Zipper. There was a Z word in there somewhere. The composer writing the music with lyricist David Zippel. So we're going to have. So why don't you say we get into our review proper? So it is a glorious day on Mount Olympus as the gods are celebrating the birth of Hercules and Hera's son. Did I say Hercules? I meant Zeus and Hera's son. That turns it into a completely different movie. But Zeus and Hera's son Hercules. Other gods are happy about this, but not Hades. Partially because Hades has a plot to overthrow Mount Olympus that's going to happen in 18 years. And the Fates have basically told him, good. Except if Hercules somehow joins this battle, yeah, that's going to put a whole kibosh on the whole Conquest Day of Olympus Day. So Hades decides to send his minions, Pain and Panic, to dispose of Hercules by delivering this liquid potion that if he drinks every drop will take every bit of his godhood, his strength, and everything away from him. Well, they are able to do it. So they kidnap Hercules and they take him down to Earth and they start feeding him this potion when an old couple for that matter, who have been childless. Well, not quite old, more middle-aged who have been childless, come running when they hear a child's crying and discover the child. And this prevents the very last drop of the potion from going to Hercules. As such, when Pain and Panic try to attack the couple and the child, Hercules still has his strength. And so the couple adopts the child and he grows up in a loving family but in an outcast of society because of his absolutely freakish strength. One day, when he's about the age of 16, his parents finally tell him the truth of him discovered on the mountain path, and he goes on a journey to the temple of Zeus to find out maybe some answers. There, Zeus explains to him that you're my son, though he kind of leaves out all the other sons he probably sired with other people, you know, when he turned into a goose. Or was it a swan? It was one of the two. Anyways, more in that, and that if he would like to join both him and his mother on Mount Olympus, he must become a true hero to regain his godhood. So he sends him to Phil, short for Philoctetes. It's a Greek word, and yeah, Phil is better, who's a satyr, who is a trainer of heroes, and thus begins Hercules' journey to become a true hero. Ladies and gentlemen, let's get into Hercules.
I have often dreamed of a far-off place where a great warm welcome will be waiting for me, where the crowds will cheer when they see my face, and a voice keeps saying, this is where I'm meant to be. I will find my way. I can go the distance. I'll be there someday. If I can be strong, I know every mile will be worth my while. I would go most anywhere to feel like I.
Thank you.
And welcome back, and let's get right back into it and start with music. And of course, being a Disney musical, we're going to start with songs. And you know, here's the interesting thing about this is, you know, I do enjoy the songs. I enjoyed all the songs for that matter. I really did. I mean, I Can Go the Distance. It was a wonderful song. It is a wonderful song. I enjoy both the in-movie version and the Michael Bolton version, which is sung during the credits. And then, you know, you had your Meg song, you know, I Won't Say I'm in Love, which is lovely. Hero, and then most of the other songs, though, are sung by the Gospel Truth. Now, as far as a, you know, connection to Greek theater, which I think that's something that a lot of people may not know of, me in particular, I just so happened to have taken a class on theater history a little last semester, so it is a lot more fresh in my mind than maybe if I hadn't. So it definitely popped into my mind. But if you've taken a class in theater and understand theater history, you, I think, would see this too. That, again, having the muses, who are the narrators, which is very traditional for Greek theater, being the core, you know, again, that the muses are usually played by the chorus in Greek theater. So for them to be a chorus to sing these musical songs that progress the story along makes a lot of sense. It's very smart and ingenious by the Disney to use that to move the story along. I know you're expecting for an if to come, and here's the if. Well, not an if, but I mean a but to come. Well, not that type of but that we like, but the but in the literal sense, as in, but this is what's wrong, and here's the but. There's here. I can speak tonight. To be technical, this morning, folks. Not that it's morning, as in it's still night, but it's morning. And I should really move on from that. But here's the problem. The problem isn't with how it's done in the story. It all works in story, and songs are nice. It's too Broadway. Yes, I just said that. Yes, I'm the one who knocked Frozen for not being Broadway enough. And here I'm saying that the music in a film is too Broadway. I guess what I'm trying to say here and say is that when you look at the Disney Renaissance and the music and the songs, yes, there's definitely a Broadway-inspired formula that's used for the songs and how they are played in the movie. Without a doubt. But if you listen to all the songs don't really sound like Broadway songs. I mean, they have certainly worked on Broadway. But if you listen to songs, it's not a song that you'll hear and say, like, yeah, this is a musical number, but it doesn't sound like a musical, like a Broadway. Like, there's this, I don't know how to describe it, but it's like a Broadway feel. You know? And it's like something that feels more like it's a play than it is a movie. Like, these, I think that's the best way to say it. It's like, the other music of the Disney Renaissance sounds like music that's part of a movie rather than it just being a musical number from Broadway. Even though, and that's what also allows it to work on Broadway. Here, this just sounds like a Broadway musical that's been adapted. Which, yes, I understand that's probably the point. Here's a better way. Rather than being something magical and special and unique, like Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin was, the music in this film came off sounding like Mamma Mia. That's the one thing that kept popping into my head. It's like, this just feels a lot like Mamma Mia. You know, like, it's these big choruses, and you don't have, like, I think that's really the problem, is that a majority of songs being sung by the chorus, though works in story. If you separate the songs from the movie, one of the things that doesn't allow them to work is that there's not that solo feel to them. And that's something that I think made all of the Disney songs work. You know, when you think about the best Disney songs, you think of Hellfire, you think of Friends on the Other Side, you have the Vilken songs for that matter, you think of Belle, you think Be Our Guest, and you think Friend Like Me, you know, they all have an element, a solo element to it. For a large majority of these songs, it's the chorus, but where it hurts it is that it gives it this Broadway feel. It feels like they're peeling back the curtain, and these songs are very bare, and they're not trying to hide how Broadway they are. You know, I've gone over this over and over in my head of how to explain this, and it's like, I really don't. This feels less like a musical, like Lion King and Beauty and the Beast. You know, they were movies first, but I'm trying to think of a musical that's like, okay, here's a better one. It feels less like La Miserable, which is this epic musical that has a lot of emotion and feels more movie-like, and more like something modern, like, I said, like Mamma Mia or Rent. Maybe that's the best way to put it, is it has that feel. And the thing about Rent and Mamma Mia is that that's the type of musical that Howard Ashman was trying to get away from, I feel. You know, Howard Ashman, I feel, when he left Broadway, felt that it was becoming too much, or was heading towards the direction of things like Rent and Mamma Mia and all these more modern songs that didn't have a magical feel to them. And that's overall the thing about the songs, is that you pull the songs away, there's this magical feel. Here, there's not as much of a magical feel, because again, it has that sort of modern sensibility about it that can at times not be timeless. And I want to say this, don't take this as me saying that the music sucks, because I don't think the music sucks. Like I said, I Can Go the Distance is a wonderful song, works tremendous in the film. I Won't Say I'm Love is a great solo song for Meg. No, not that Meg. Get your mind off Family Guy. Again, this primarily goes to the chorus, and I'm really torn on this, because on one hand, it's absolutely brilliant to have the chorus do the singing, because it ties in the Greek theater, and in that sense, it's ingenious, but the actual music itself is a bit too Broadway, and I do think that did affect audiences. I think there was a bit of magic missing, and I think that's the best way to describe it, is it's not so much that the songs were bad, but because they seemingly appeared to be too modern-day Broadway, some of that Disney magic of the music was gone. Some of the fun was gone. Because again, it's Howard Ashman definitely wrote a lot of songs. You know, Friends Like Me was definitely a Broadway number, but it was this more high production, more magical number, as opposed to this. It didn't have that same type of magic feel. And let's not knock it. These films were definitely being compared by the audience to the films before. And, you know, here's the thing. When you reach perfection, everything else it is going to be considered a failure. Yeah, let's just state that right now. Whether it's a failure or not, it's besides the point. It's never going to, when you reach perfection, nothing can be better than perfection. There's no such thing as more perfect. or more than perfect, I should say. There is such a thing as more perfect. Anyway, we find these truths we self-evident in order to become more perfect people. Again, I'm not getting into that whole story, but let's continue with the score. The score I absolutely love. I find it to be absolutely wonderful. Aaron Menken did a great job. Integrating I Can Go to Distance a lot into it as well. I love the Hydra number. Hail Hydra! that actually works in Disney now. But that Hydra fight scene, I really enjoyed the music. I thought it worked really well in that scene. And just overall throughout the movie, there were a lot of great scenes. You know, the whole Meg, Hercules date, the musical score behind there, I thought was just wonderful as well. Alan Menken just has a wonderful, wonderful ear, I think, for scoring movies. And I think his ability to score movies is tremendously underrated. Because he does such a great job, and there's such magic to it as well. You know, everybody focuses on his songs because of what he did with Howard Ashman and what he's done, you know, after Howard Ashman unfortunately passed away, with things like Hunchback of Notre Dame and Hercules and other movies. But because of that, I think his score isn't as appreciated as it should be. And definitely here, because it's absolutely tremendous. Again, right up there with the other stuff he's done. Let's move on to animation. And I love the animation. You know, overall style was just beautiful. They went with this sort of soft Greek style look overall for the characters. That sort of matches the sort of painting style. Very soft line. You know, if you look at Greek art, not Greek artists, modern time, but like classical Greek art and classical inspired art, those very soft lines and everything that work very, very well, are pretty much throughout, you know, again, that soft touch with the paint, a very much of a water painting color. And that's the other thing, there's definitely an inspiration by sort of classical Renaissance paintings of Greek. Which is funny because we reviewed Fantasia, and again, that whole Beethoven piece was also inspired by classical Renaissance paintings of Greece. And here you have it again. In fact, Andreas Deja said that there was a lot of inspiration. No, it was Eric Goldberg, I'm sorry, who said that in doing Phil, he took a lot of inspiration from... I know he took from Fantasia. What was the other one he said? Yeah, well, Grumpy and Snow White, but he also meant Bacchus in Fantasia. And in fact, when you see Bacchus in the film, or when I saw him in the film, all I could think of was like, oh, I know they had to take that from Fantasia, because he does look very much... In fact, he has the same purple color that he does in Fantasia as well. I think this is a great... segueing two character designs. I really enjoyed them. Hercules, both young and old, I thought worked very, very well. I actually enjoyed the almost kind of bony feel to young Hercules. And I love the symbolism there. It's like he has all this strength, but he really doesn't know how to use it. And so that look is very symbolic of... I'm about to say how much of an amateur he is, but maybe that's the best way to say it, because he's not yet learned what it means to be a hero. He doesn't have control of it. He hasn't mastered anything of his strength, for that matter. So that's very symbolic of it. And then in that sense, you also have the very symbolic feel of being overly muscular like he is once his training is done. That's sort of the symbol. Yeah, he's mastered his strength. Though I will say this, I think he's a bit over-muscular once his training is complete, once he, you know, after that part. The one thing about his character design I don't like is I think he's a bit too muscular. I mean, obviously, you know, they were inspired by the Lou Ferrigno Hercules, Oh, God, what's the other... Kevin Sorbo. That was it. That was the name I was trying to think of. I obviously... The design was, in particular, during the mid-90s when Kevin Sorbo's Hercules was immensely popular. So, yeah, they obviously took inspiration of Kevin Sorbo from his TV series Hercules. There was a 1970s Hercules series with Lou Ferrigno, you know, the Incredible Hulk from the 1970s Hulk series. So, yeah, that muscular feel definitely came from that. But I think it would have... I think it would have made the film a bit more unique if he was a bit more toned than muscular. So that's my criticism of his character design. Megara's design I absolutely enjoyed. I love the slimness. You know, again, much more unique. Much more of a slim beauty than a more full-figure beauty that other princesses had been. So I thought her design worked very well. And again, her color scheme also, I thought, provided great contrast to Hercules' yellow, her purple. Phil is, again, one of the... You know, just like if you look at the genie, you can see, like, yeah, they're inspired by Robin Williams. You can see that they're definitely inspired by Danny DeVito in this design. And obviously, you know, again, it's one of those cases to where they built the character around Danny DeVito with the attention, and even though he initially didn't accept the invitation, he eventually did. But like the first time they tried to like sell him on the idea, he rejected it, and then they did some line reading and auditioning for other people, and then they tried again with him, and he accepted. But, you know, his design works very well as the comedy fodder, to put it in a better way. You know, again, it goes back to that whole thing of, you know, like Iago. You know, when in doubt, hit the bird. You know, again, you see all the comedy tropes of John Musker and Ron Clements here, definitely. But I thought his design worked very well for being the comedy part of the duo. This sort of... I want to say straight man. What's it? Straight man and then the other man. He's the other man. Or is he the straight... I'm blanking. Anyways, you... Yeah, I really paid attention in theater class. and all the characters... You know, I guess Hades is, again, has a very unique design. Definitely. You know, when you talk about designs of Hades through film history, this Hades has definitely come up as very unique. I love the idea of the flame as the hair and everything. I thought that worked tremendously well as an idea. And again, just the color scheme, the very dark, deathly, bluish-white skin, and the black robes, that gave this very deathly look to him, very grim, not Grim Reaper-like, because that would require a hood, I think. But, you know, again, he definitely looked like he was an element of death. So I love that aspect of his design. And then Pain and Panic, again, you know, the villain comedy sidekicks, here, again, like Iago, when in doubt, hurt the sidekicks, and definitely they had the design emphasizing that. And again, they were the cute, like, funny villain sidekicks everybody laughed at. That worked really, really well. I really enjoyed the action animation here. I mean, the action animation is just beautiful. You know, it's very unique to look at it now, unfortunately, though. Because I do think it hasn't aged as well. This, again, because of the age we live in and how far CG has come, you know, it's very obvious that it, you know, like, for instance, in the Hydra fight, Hydra is CG, even though it, again, and this is why I point to the fact that, you know, you can't use CG to imitate hand-drawn. You just can't, because it won't have the same soul. Because when the Hydra comes out, you know, look at it two ways. Let's look at the Hydra fight and the Cyclops fight. The Cyclops is hand-drawn, and it fits with everything, and, you know, even if it is CG, there's nothing to it that pops as being completely different from the rest of the scenery, from the hand-drawn backgrounds and hand-drawn characters and everything. But with the Hydra, it's CG, and, you know, while it has its own unique look, there's something about it that makes it pop off the screen in the wrong way, where it feels like something different has been introduced into this film, and it becomes very obvious. You know, now, mind you, I like the Hydra scene, and I like the Hydra fight as the first fight of Hercules, which we'll get to in story. But again, from an animation standpoint, there's not that buffer there to separate, and it just it's almost like it's a hard line that's really separating the two. And, you know, the Hydra feels like a completely different art style. Even though it's the same art style, it feels like it's a different art style. But outside of that, I enjoyed all the action animation. It was very fun, and again, I think the Disney artists have a great sense of action motion. The chase scenes, the fight scenes, I thought they all worked very, very well. And then, of course, you have the backgrounds and special effects. Backgrounds, once again, it's Disney. It's beautiful. The special effects are on point. There's really not much to say. I almost want to say it's typical Disney, because it pretty much is. As in that, you know, it's perfection. The backgrounds are just gorgeous to look at, you know. There's the shot where the Cyclops is, like, trashing thieves. That was a beautiful shot, and really gave a perspective to the size of the Cyclops. The same thing can be said for Olympus and, you know, the Titans and everything. And there was just, I thought there was great perspective in the backgrounds, and, you know, the way the backgrounds were done to show the size of beings like the Titans and the Cyclops, I thought was done extremely well. And then, of course, the special effects are just, nobody does special effects better than Disney. And again, the way the rain and everything and just shadow is just so on point. And again, adds to that sense of reality. So overall, the art is just fantastic, once again, by Disney. A couple hiccups here or there, you know, a couple design elements that I think didn't work, in particular with Hercules as far as being a bit too muscular, but outside of that, I really can't find anything wrong with the art. It's just absolutely on point. It's Disney artists holding themselves to the highest standard and doing it very, very well. So, with that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to get into acting and into story. So, we'll be right back, folks. After these messages, we'll be right
back. Superman.
Captain Marvel.
Batman.
It is 1985.
Robin of Earth 2.
Sergeant Rock.
The Legion of Superheroes.
This is the most eagerly awaited comic book event in 50 years.
Tommy Tomorrow.
Jonah Hex.
Commandy.
It will one day be called the greatest comic book event of all time.
Swamp Thing.
Wonder Woman.
The New Teen Titans.
The Haunted Tank.
Infinity Incorporated.
Worlds will live.
Green Arrow.
Worlds will die.
Supergirl.
The Flash.
And that is only the beginning.
The Justice League of America.
The All-Star Squadron.
The Huntress.
Ariana.
The Metal Man.
Firestorm. The Nuclear
Man. Outsiders.
Green Lantern.
The Blue Beetle.
The Crime Syndicate.
Warlord.
The Guardians of the Universe.
Tales of the Justice Society of America proudly presents,
and many, many more,
Crisis on Infinite Earths. The DC Universe will never be the same.
Coming January only at twotruefreaks.com.
I I guess you weren't so tough after all, were you? Now it's time to send you to the next dimension.
291 original episodes.
This can't be. It's still going up!
325 manga chapters.
You act innocent, but you're deadly.
Time to die!
Dozens of characters, hundreds of enemies, and a whole lot of violence.
That kind of violence is pointless!
You see, Super Saiyans tend to be a bit violent.
Oh, crap!
Join hosts Donovan and Jesse as they cover the arrival of the Saiyans, the journey to Namek, the battle with Frieza, the mystery of the androids, and the terror of Majin Buu.
I lied when I said you could go. At least partially lied, for I will let you go to another dimension!
The Next Dimension, a Dragon Ball Z podcast. Join the fight at dbznextdimension.libsyn.com.
See ya.
Greetings, podcast listener. Do you like...
Gotcha, Mom!
Or maybe...
Dragon! Flame!
How about...
Tatsuo! Arinda!
Or...
In the year 1999, an abandoned alien battle fortress crash-landed on the planet Earth. Our most brilliant scientist and engineer spent the next 10 years reconstructing the damaged ship and studying its highly advanced space technology called Robotech.
Do you remember...
Our Star Blazers!
Or this?
The year is after Colony 195. As the world constantly changes in the chaotic era, there are two mobile suits that could turn humans into the ultimate weapon. The Wing Zero, and the Epion.
Or maybe even this.
After the desire for blood rules all, the only hope left is the one they call D.
Or this.
Gene, grappler ship's dead ahead!
It wouldn't be fun otherwise! Let's do it!
Or...
If Cardis is allowed to be reborn, she'll destroy Marmo as well as Lodos!
Or have you seen the latest episode of...
And just like that, everything changed. At that terrible moment, in our hearts, we knew. Home was a pen. Humanity, cattle.
If you answered yes to any of these questions, then you should check out Anime Freaks, hosted by Dr. Bill Robinson and me, Gene Hendricks. Anime Freaks is a monthly podcast covering all things anime. It is available at twotruefreaks.com. and on iTunes under Two True Freaks Presents Anime Freaks.
Hey everyone, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And we host a podcast called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Presented by the Superman homepage. On the show... Wait.
What?
This just isn't working out for me. It's not... bombastic enough. We need something epic.
Like what?
Welcome to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, presented by the Superman homepage. I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am Michael Bailey.
From Crisis to Crisis chronicles the adventures of Superman.
Wait. I'm just not feeling this.
I'm just wondering how there's a needle scratching sound when all of this is clearly digital.
Look, all we need to say is that this is a trailer for a show called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by the Superman homepage. My name is Michael Bailey.
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And every week we give in-depth synopsis and reviews for just about every Superman book published between Man of Steel number 1 in 1986.
And Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. We also talk about the related Superman media, what was happening in the rest of the world when these comics were published, and what else was going on in the DC Universe.
The show drops every Thursday-ish at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com.
From Crisis to Crisis is also a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
So join Jeffrey and I each week as we explore Superman during the post-crisis era, which includes Exile, Panic in the Sky, Doomsday, The Marriage, and beyond.
And write into the show at FromCrisisToCrisis@gmail.com and hear it read on the air, eventually, because we get behind on that sort of thing.
Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Side effects from Crisis to Crisis include loss of money from buying back issues, a desire to read 20-year-old comic books, nausea, drowsiness, pizza, blurred vision, upset stomach, a desire to kick puppies and kittens, and backache from lifting boxes of Superman comics. If the excitement of From Crisis to Crisis lasts more than 4 hours, seek immediate medical attention.
And welcome back, and let's get right back into it, as we do with acting. And I'm actually very happy, because now it's time to do our cast list, where I get to make mention of some of my favorite Greg Wiseman connections here. First, we have Tate Donovan voicing Hercules, with the younger version being voiced by Josh Keaton, better known for those who've heard my other podcast as Spectacular Spider-Man, and at least in my mind, the best Spider-Man voice as far as an animated series. Hell, I'll even say this. Spectacular Spider-Man is the best Spider-Man of anything that's been put in entertainment, my personal opinion. To me, my Spider-Man is Josh Keaton. Playing the role of Phil, you have Danny DeVito, Megara, voiced by Susan Egan. James Woods voices the Lord of the Underworld, Hades. You have one of my favorite 80s comedians, Bobcat Goldthwait, as Pain, and Matthew Frewer as Panic. You have Rip Thorne voicing Zeus, and Samantha Eggar as Hera. You have Lilias White, Cheryl Freeman, Lachenza, Roy Ryans, and Vanessa Yee Thomas as the Muses, that chorus that narrates the story. Frank Wechter is Pegasus, Amanda Plummer, Carol Shelley, Patty Edwards as the Fates, and of course you also have some cameo appearances here. You have Paul Schaefer as Hermes, because apparently David Letterman was huge in the 90s. I was more of a Jay Leno guy. Wayne Knight as Demetrius. And I'm shocked he, considering the sort of superhero worship here, he didn't tell Hercules to, grab your Big Mac and your Wheaties and get your Hanes on, time to go. Space Jam. And, of course, speaking of Greg, Charleston Heston has a cameo role as an opening narrator. And let's not forget, one more, Greg Wiseman. And Gargoyle's reference as Keith David, the legendary Keith David, is Apollo. For, I think, like, one line. So, overall, I really enjoyed the voice acting. I thought Tate Dunn did a great job as just, again, it's almost that, well, it's not quite the Superman thing. I was about to say it's the Superman thing, but to be fair to Superman, Superman is very intelligent, and he plays the sort of innocent, naive farm boy. Here, Donovan is playing the naive farm boy, because really that's what Hercules is. He's, raised in the country, he's not used to the big city, and, he's very simple, and he, in a sense, he's very pure, and I think Tate Donovan does a great job of bringing that through to the character with his voice. I thought he did a great job. Same with Josh Keaton. Josh Keaton's role, again, Josh Keaton has just, I think, great range for animation projects. And he did a wonderful job here of just portraying this sort of outcast that just wants to know where he belongs. So I thought that was extremely well done by both actors. Both played their parts extremely well. Danny DeVito. Was Danny DeVito. Because basically that's what his character was. His character was all designed around being Danny DeVito. And so if you're a fan of Danny DeVito, like I am, you really enjoyed it. If you're not, you're not. And I guess that's what it is. Definitely he was a major name, and I think, unlike Robin Williams, would Robin Williams and the Genie people went in knowing that basically the genie was going to be Robin Williams, but still, it was this big thing, and it, the genie had its own unique character, so where, yeah, you know it's Robin Williams, but it's really the genie. As good as Danny DeVito is, and this is not on Danny DeVito, this is on the direction, or more importantly, how the audience accepted it. And sometimes that's really what it is. It's sometimes you can do everything right, and the audience just doesn't accept it. And I think this is one of those things to where, like I said, if you're not a fan of Danny DeVito, or you're really just not a fan of, like, big names, like, characters that are basically those big names, you know, that's what Phil comes off as. It's just, it's Danny DeVito. So, it comes off as not being, feeling like it's a unique character. And again, it's not Danny DeVito's fault, because, again, it's more how the character was built. They basically tried the same thing they did with the genie, but for whatever reason, the genie just... And I'm going to bring up the genie in a little bit as well. But the genie had this very unique, magical attribute about him. Again, we'll talk about what that is in a story, because that's really where we can kind of talk about it. But it has to deal with his magical being, allowing it to be a device for characters, for the audience to believe certain things existing, like his voice being that of Robin Williams. But here, there's nothing really magical other than he's a satire. Other than that, he really has no magical being. So him being basically Danny DeVito doesn't feel right. And there's no uniqueness to his character because of that. That being said, I thought Danny DeVito did a great job, and he had a lot of passion in his voice. And it just... I really loved the character. His character was really funny. I laughed at his character. I thought he did a great job here. Again, the criticism here is not on Danny DeVito. It's on the character. And it's on an element of this movie, which we'll be talking about in a little bit. Susan Egan just was wonderful as Megara. You know, I really love Meg in this movie, because just such an interesting character. And what they did, there's this whole sort of separate sort of story theme going on with her character that worked so well. And Susan Egan did a wonderful job at it. You know, I've actually found a unique doing research. She was actually the initial Belle on Broadway. When they brought Beauty and the Beast to Broadway, she played Belle. It's like, you know what? I can see that. And I'm blanking on her name because, you know, I don't have it in notes. But the original voice of Belle in Beauty and the Beast, not my favorite, but yeah, I'd find it interesting to see her like do another dub where she does. But we'll have a fan. Someone will pay her money to do a fan dub that will be sent for free on the internet of her playing Belle. And then you have the supporting cast. Frank Wendler is an animal. He's a horse. What more can you say other than we can use a real horse, or we can get Frank? Let's go with Frank. He takes direction better. And then, of course, Zeus by Rick Thorne. Why do I keep calling him Thorne? It's Thorne. Rick Thorne always has had a unique voice. I think it's one of the things that made the Men in Black series so much interesting. And I thought he did a great job. It's like, you hear that voice, I'm like, yeah, this sounds like what Zeus should sound like. That sort of papa type of voice. And I thought it worked very well. Samantha Eggar just had this very motherly sound to her as Hera. And so as, the father and mother god, I thought it worked very well. I enjoyed the Muses as this sort of... I got the feeling that they wanted this chorus to be sort of like a, Motown band. Because again, that the song's really Motown-ish. And again, that goes to that modern aspect I was talking about with music that kind of hurts it to where it's that Motown feel to it. And, definitely you hear it here. The Muses definitely, at least the way when they were acting, definitely had this, Motown, like, black girls in the beauty shop. talking about, you know, what happened there in the City Hall. I'm like, you hear about the affair that went down there? Now, if that was my man. I have watched Barbershop and Beauty Shop way too much. Because I'm a sucker for that type of comedy. And like I said, you know, Wayne Knight in his cameo was very funny. You know, Jim Cummings as Nexus, as we're getting into the antagonist here, he's very funny because, again, it's Jim Cummings, and again, he's along with Scott McNeil and Steve Bloom and you know, others. He's on, and, you know, he's in that, you know, top five pantheon of like under guys, right under the god himself, whose name I'm blanking on. It's early in the morning. I can't think. But then going into antagonist, James Wood was just brilliant. Absolutely brilliant as Hades. I loved him as Hades. It, you know, again, just really gave a great definition to the character. And that sort of like, almost, you know, slick salesman. Like, you know, he's that car salesman that's very evil, and, you know, he's going to tell you everything you want to know about this car, and he's going to sell you this car. He's like, you're going to get the greatest car ever, and then no more than 5 minutes on the road, you're 5 miles away, it breaks down, and then you realize the warranty was 4 miles, so the warranty is gone. He's that type of car salesman. And it's just that slick, underhanded, just all creepy and just so quick witted, and, you know, the fact that he apparently ad-libbed a lot of his lines. I think my favorite scene, again, it goes to that the Hydra fight, where he's sitting there, and again, he makes the football like, boys, it's only halftime. It just has that, like, come, like, I'm not worried about anything. I'm cool, and I'm collected. I'm like, yeah. And then, of course, when he does get angry, it works so well to his advantage. So, not quite the level of, I'm blanking on characters' names and actors' names here, but, you know, to judge from Hunchback of Notre Dame. But definitely up there as again, Disney villains are just so well portrayed. You know, that's the thing I think has to be acknowledged. It is one of Disney's best attributes is that they create some great villains for our heroes to go up against. And they definitely feel like a challenge. You know, here you had a sense to where definitely the hero had the strength, the physical strength advantage. But again, James Woods did a great job of just seeming cool, calm, and collected in that and not seeming worried. Except as he got progressively angrier as the movie went on. So I thought James Woods did a great job in that. And then you have his minions. And like I said, it's the comedy relief. And they did a great job. They had great chemistry. But again, every time I hear Bobcat's voice, it's like, if you've heard Bobcat go with, you know, high-pitched voice, you know what it is. And it's just, it always works. And he's always just like, I don't know. It's like, maybe if he finds out. I can't do an impression of him to save my life. Nobody can. That's why it's such a unique voice. And that's why he's just so funny. And the thing is, he doesn't really talk like that. I don't know if it's still on Netflix, but he had a comedy special that was up on Netflix about, I want to say, a year ago. Very funny. Stand-up's very funny. So I definitely suggest you check him out as well, if you can, on Netflix. With that, let's move on to story. And, you know, one thing I love about the main plot, and the main plot is simple. It's a hero trying to get back to Mount Olympus. And it really follows in that Greek tradition of the hero's journey. You know, the hero, whether knowingly or unknowingly, does something that causes him to fall out of favor from the gods, whether he does it or not. And he has to basically go on a journey to get back to Mount Olympus. This is what, you know, Kratos does in God of War. This is the whole premise behind the Hercules legend. You know, the premise behind the Odyssey and all the other Greek tales. It, you know, you have these heroes who, you know, fall, and then they have to get back up. And that's the whole point of the story. It's that overlying theme in Greek hero journeys about when you fall, you pick yourself up and get back up and move on. So again, this definitely follows into that. And in this case, his crime, whether not knowing it, is angering, you know, again, you anger one god and they cause something to you and you have to go on that journey. In this case, he angered Hades by the fact that the fates told that the prophecy of him stopping. And that same point in time, this also goes into the whole idea of Greek ideas of a fate. You know, Hades learns the fate that Hercules would be the one to stop him. So he, in turn, tries to change what's going to happen. But in turn, ultimately, that leads to Hercules being the one being there to stop him. You know, it could be questioned that if he did nothing, you know, Hercules may not have even been there. He could have been slick and, like, as he's about to attack, like, send Hercules to the other side of the world, and then attacked. So, yeah, and again, and that's really the cornerstone of this plot, and that's why Hercules' character, being sort of the pure farm boy that he is here, works so well. Because, again, it's that hero's journey. Trying to be a true hero. And that connects with the overall theme of he's just trying to find out what will finally make him a true hero so that he can reach his goal of being back on Mount Olympus. That's the whole premise. You know, he wants to be back with his mother and father. He wants to be where he thinks he belongs. And so he has that goal to reach it. And of course, he realizes afterwards that's not where he belongs, and he belongs with Meg, Megara, and, you know, he ultimately goes back to Earth. But, again, it's that journey to discover that. And, again, that's where the theme of true hero comes. You know, what makes him a true hero isn't his amazing strength and his ability to defeat all these monsters. It's his heart. You know, it's the heart that makes the hero, not the strength. And that's the overall theme. What separates him from everybody else isn't all the merchandise and everything. It's his heart. You know, when you look at the heroes that we look up to, like in sports, what separates Michael Jordan from all the other players isn't the fact that on a dime he can drop 50 points in any game or do an amazing dunk. Or even his leadership. Because his leadership's tied to the one thing that makes him a true hero, and that's his heart. Michael Jordan, and I'm bringing up Michael Jordan because there's obvious reference in comparing Hercules in a way to our modern sports heroes of the time, which at the time of this movie was Michael Jordan. You know, that's why I made the whole joke about Wayne Knight. But it's his heart, because you'll never see Michael Jordan give up. For today's term, you'll never see LeBron James give up on a game. You'll never see, as much as I hate to say it, Tom Brady give up on a game. You know, that's why he's considered one of the best quarterbacks of all times and has all those Super Bowl rings. Same with Joe Montana and Steve Young and all the great quarterbacks. That's the true definition of a hero. And mind you, I'm using sports because that's probably the closest we have to modern-day gladiators, and sort of those are where our big heroes lie. You know, for me, I'm a wrestling fan. The thing that really separates John Cena from all the other wrestlers, and why he's been the face of the industry of wrestling, aka sports entertainment, is his heart. So, in this sense, again, showing Hercules going the journey and trying to obtain that true hero, when he's doing all these great feats, but he's not there yet. But it's when he sacrifices himself for somebody else, and is willing to continue the fight, even though he doesn't have his godlike strength that's been taken away from him. That's when he becomes a true hero. So that overall theme is just played tremendously well throughout the movie. And another thing, and I may mention to it before, is Megara. It's just a genius play because, again, the whole play on the whole damsel in distress archetype, in the fact that, you know, she goes out and she plays a damsel in distress even though she isn't, but at the same time playing off that strong female character archetype that is so prevalent in Disney films and is a huge part of their success. Because you have sort of them playing with both archetypes and playing around, and I almost get the sense here that what they're trying to say is, you know, regardless of what her character is, what her archetype and what everything is, she's first a female character. And that's what she is. She's a character that is female. It doesn't matter whether she's a damsel in distress or the strong independent type. You know, what matters is her journey and what she wants. And again, then that's the whole thing that she, her character has to struggle through, you know, throughout the movie. You know, a lot of what her story is, you would see in other movies, being the male's character's journey. And that's what I find so unique about her character. You know, the lover who left her after she sacrificed for him. You know, a whole, that's almost like a play on the prince's story, to where, you know, the prince sacrifices everything for the girl and gets the girl in the end. Well, here she sacrificed everything, including her soul, to get the guy back, and then the guy left her. And now her soul is in the control of Hades, who probably has something to do with that. You know what? It's almost, actually, it's very funny. If you actually think about it, and I kind of had this epiphany, it's basically, her story is what would have happened if Ursula won. Because think about it. Ariel wants to get the guy. Ursula gives her the power to get the guy. Then tries to take the guy away before she can complete the deal so that she can get her soul. But Ariel is able to stop her. Well, in this case, she sold her soul to Hades to get the guy. But this time, the guy was essentially stolen away by another woman, the implication is. Though, you get the, you wouldn't be, again, I don't think it's that much of a stretch to say, yeah, that other woman was probably sent by Hades. And so, it's this little nod, by the way, to The Little Mermaid, and there's a lot of Disney nods. I mean, goddammit, have Hercules wearing Scar, for God's sakes. I'm like, goddammit. That one was really jarring. It's like, really? Really? You're having him wear Scar? Really? You're gonna have him do that? God damn you, Disney. But yeah, it's such a smart archetype of playing you, because you have people, I mean, still today, the big thing about how women are portrayed in entertainment, and this, I thought, smartly played with it to showcase that it doesn't matter what the archetype is, because it's about her character and her story, and do you do it successfully? And I thought they did it tremendously well here. This character who had been broken in the past, finding herself, and rescuing herself. Because again, she's the one who saves Hercules and ultimately allows his powers to come back. You know, she selfishly sacrifices her life to push him out of the way, and ultimately saves him, and basically, she's responsible for saving the world, even though it's through her that Hades is able to take his powers away initially. So you have, because of a woman, a man's power being taken away, but because of a woman, it being given back. I just think that the way they do it, and it's the deep layers of it, I thought was extremely well done. Now, where this film hurts, I think, is in its comedy. Now, I like the comedy. I like all the pop culture references and everything. It's classic John Musker and Ron Clements. But the reason I think this hurts the film is it's not a criticism of the comedy. And again, this is what goes to Phil being basically Danny DeVito. is there's really no device for the comedy to filter through. And what I mean by that, and this is where I got into a debate and argument with some of my friends about this movie about. When you watch Aladdin, the genie is clearly as plain as day explained as a magical being. You know, he's a genie who lives in a lamp. You have that innate understanding automatically that he's this magical being. And so, why can't he reference something that's from the future? Because he exists in all time. So, what to say that he, when he was initially out before, had been set in the future, hadn't seen all the history, knows everything and anything that needs to be done? I mean, he's the all-powerful genie. And so you can filter all this pop culture comedy and everything through him to where he can have Robin Williams' voice. And he can do all these wacky, you know, basically create a Macy's Day, Thanksgiving Day parade in presenting Prince Ali in a location in history that should have none of that. And all those other pop culture references. Well, here, I mean, you have Hercules being popular, and you have Air Herx, which is a reference to the Air Jordans, and sports drinks, and action figures, and everything. And all of this pop culture reference, but there is not a filter of a filter device that is there for the audience to make it believable. And that's the thing. Comedy still has to be believable. And I know people are probably sitting here and saying, like, wait a minute, then why do you like Etchy? Well, Etchy is still believable. You know, it's still satire and it's still other things in a certain way, which would be a long explanation that I want to go into because we are already deep on time. But to put it in case here, there's not a filter to make the comedy believable. You know, comedy has to be made believable. And here, there's not really that filter device to make the pop culture references make sense. And I think people don't acknowledge that in talking about this movie. And I think that's one of the things that need audiences not enjoy the movie as much. It's not so much that the comedy was bad, but because there wasn't that filter, it made it seem old hat. It made it seem like this was rehashed. Like, oh, they're just doing the formula they did to make Aladdin. And so it made it feel like Aladdin ripoff. And so people felt like Disney wasn't trying. And that can affect how an audience thinks about a movie, whether it worked or not. You know, again, it goes back to the thing. If the audience thinks a certain thing of your movie, perception is everything. And if they think that thing about your movie, that's what they're going to think about the movie, regardless of really how wrong they may be. And certainly, there's a lot about this movie that I think audiences are wrong about, but because of that perception, and particularly here with the comedy, where they have no filter device to make the comedy believable. So, you know, they create a perception that it's rehashed and old. And even I got that. But then I realized just how ingenious it was because I can see beyond that perception. So the comedy is good because, again, it doesn't have that device to filter it. It can not seem as believable and it can seem rehashed. But again, that's also, again, it's the motif. You know, that's the thing is, somebody who isn't a fan of theater, they won't see it as a motif, the stylings of Ron Clements and John Lasseter. All the comedy here is definitely John Clements and Ron Lasseter style. And so I tremendously enjoyed it. But again, like I said, I think the audience created a perception because they didn't have that filter, the device to filter pop culture comedy through to make it make sense to be in Agent Grease. I guess last but not least is the pacing, and I thought the pacing was done tremendously well. Again, it had just a nice steady pace, and the film moved at just a steady click, and, you know, at no point did I feel bored. Like, I paused the movie several times, but that's because I was discussing in my head several aspects of characters. So overall, I really enjoyed this film. You know, the sad part about it is, again, some of the criticisms I have, not all. I mean, like I said, criticism about Hercules being a bit too muscular. That's also a personal thing. But a lot of it is certain things in this film allowed a certain perception of this film to be created about it and about Disney. Or it at least strengthened the thought process of Disney just trying to do the same formula over and over again, which it was. But again, the perception is that that was a bad thing. Because they weren't trying. When it was quite the opposite, that the formula is a good thing, and that they absolutely were trying. But certain elements didn't allow the audience to really appreciate it. Which, one of the good things I think that's happened with time is that the audience does realize their mistake, and then you get people loving a film more and more. We've seen that with Hunchback of Notre Dame. We've seen this with this film. I know a lot of friends who said they didn't like Hercules when it came out, but now they look back on it and they realize really how much more smarter it was than they really gave it credit for, and they're enjoying it. So, overall, I think this is a really good film. And then, it's John Clements, Ron Musker, and them, and then these guys and their team did a terrific job with the film. It's fun. It's just fun to watch. The music is enjoyable, if a bit too Broadway, and doesn't quite have that same Disney magic as the other songs of past Disney movies have. And just overall, just I can enjoy watching this over and over again. So, at the end of the day, I give Disney's Hercules a 4 out of 5. Just a really good movie, really fun to watch, and really enjoy it. So, that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I have, and I've enjoyed this year's Disney Month. You know, it's really been fun. It's always fun to watch. I need to watch Disney more often than I do. It's just finding the time. But again, see, I always have the feeling like I just want to just run through Disney movies until I do all the Disney movies. But like, this is why I keep it to a month and limit how many I do a year. So I build my excitement for it. So it's kind of sad that this is the last movie I'll be reviewing of the year. That's, or at least that is, Disney animation. Well, again, you never know, but hey, why confuse it now? So, remember, if you have any emails or comments or anything you want to leave the show, there are certain ways to contact the show. One, you can email the show at Absolution Network. You can email us at AbsolutionNetwork132@gmail.com. That's AbsolutionNetwork132@gmail.com. You can also leave us a comment on Stitcher, which you can find at www.stitcher.com. You can listen to the podcast there, like us, and leave us a comment there. You can also leave us a comment on our Facebook page that you can find at www.facebook.com. Search for the Absolution Network and like us and leave us a comment there. And of course, you can always leave a comment on the website itself that you can find at www.an.132productions.com. And of course, while you're there, check out all the other 132 productions, including right here on the Absolution Network. You have the Animecast, the Otaku Momentum, Shin Tiger Curls Wrestling, Anime, and Video Game videos. You have John Ramos' Toku videos. And of course, all my other stuff, which includes CMG's Wrestling Reviews, the Intergalactic Graphic Review, and Tom's Top 10, among other things. And then, of course, there's my comic book crazy site at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com, where you can find my old comic book podcast, Comic Book Crazy, Hexcast, and Spectacular Webs. And then, of course, my Tokyo SOS, a Godzilla podcast, where you can find my Godzilla podcast at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And while you're at any of those sites, check out their sidebars, where you can find all our friends, including Michael Bailey, Views from the One Box, Spidey Dude and the Clone Saga Chronicles, Steven Syker and the Critical Hit Podcast, and of course, Sky Gun and the Two Freaks Podcasting Network. And that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Next week, well, next week's very special for me, because next week is Passover. And I'm going to review a film that I've been going to review on Passover week, but the past 2 years, things have come up and things got pushed back and it's fallen off Netflix and I haven't been able to review it. And I'm going to do two things, because there's a new thing added to Netflix that is a Muppet type of thing. So I'm going to be doing two reviews. I'm going to do a short review, first of Passover at Bubby Aunt Bubby's, which is a Muppet thing from 1998. But then we'll get into our main review of The Prince of Egypt. By the way, did I mention that Passover isn't my favorite holiday in the world? Oh, this is going to be fun. So, until next time, my tsunami generation.
Find cover. It's going to get too dangerous for you.
Stay golden.
Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.